think we're going to go ahead and start to be mindful and respectful of people's times. It's great to see everyone. It's you can't tell it because we have the blinds closed, but it's a beautiful day out. I hope that lifts people's spirits. Everyone can hear me? Yes? Okay, good. Sorry, I just saw some folks look like maybe they couldn't hear. So I just want to do a brief call to order and briefly run down a few events and announcements before we turn to our business today. We last met in March, so not a whole lot has happened new, but we've had busy activities and some great events. I just want to mention a few: our youth law fair and our law day that we had here with the American Constitution Society were both fabulous events. Youth law fair, we were down at the courts. We partner with our superior court. And we have middle school and high school kids that come in that get to act as prosecutors and judges and witnesses and defense counsel for trials. We had over 100 kids. It was a really fabulous event. It was a lot of fun. We had an Ask a Lawyer panel after the mock trials, and the kids just had great questions. So that was a great day. And then here, we had Law Day with the American Constitution Society last week. We had just about 200 kids that were here. We partner with the American Constitution Society, I think just about every year, although we've been on the hiatus since the pandemic. And thanks to Pat McGlone, who was here with us, who kind of germinated this idea to partner with them and to basically bring kids in. And these were all ages from third grade up to seniors in high school to learn about the Constitution, the law, the Bill of Rights, and what being a citizen means. And we broke them up into age-appropriate groups for discussion, and volunteer lawyers came in. One of our past presidents, Andy Marks, served as one of the discussion leaders, and it was a really, really fun day. So it's a tradition that we look forward to continuing. We also had a number of voluntary bar events go on. I won't go through all of them, but many of them hit important themes that we've been thinking about. The Women's Bar Association had a well-being summit where members of our lawyer assistance program spoke. I spoke on a panel. It was a great day. We had the Washington Bar Association had an event at Howard Law School where they unveiled a portrait for our chief judge, Anna Blackburn Rigsby, and that was fabulously well attended. And the chief judge was very touched to have such a large segment of our DC law community and her friends and family that were there to support her. We also hosted here Civil Rights and Social Justice section of the ADA. They had their Economic Justice Forum. We were co-sponsors of the event. We had a reception up on the 8th floor, a beautiful space up there for them on one of their evenings after their program. And Charles also introduced one of their speakers for their Friday morning program. And then I want to turn to Charles in a minute because he and Bob also have been traveling. As you may recall, I mentioned that ABA has their Bar Leadership Institute every year in March. It's a wonderful program that brings together bar leaders from all over the country and has programs to help train them in terms of governance issues, how to conduct a meeting, hot topics for bar associations, mandatory bars versus voluntary bars. So Charles, if you have a minute, tell us a little bit about how the conference went and maybe what you found most helpful from the couple days session.
Well, thank you, Ellen. Yes, the my first time, I guess my time going to the BLI in Chicago, and I found that the sessions to be very interesting, informative, which is great to meet. Some of the DC Bar members were also there representing. I found it to be very helpful. I guess overall, I would just say that I learned a lot. Particularly had time, to spend with Bob, Aaron, and I think that was really helpful. And just look forward to using the materials, the information that they brought with us, brought to the conference as I move forward to.
Great, yeah. Thank you, Charles. I'd also like to give a shout out to Bob. Every year, our president-elect attends this conference with our leadership team. And as usual, Bob was everywhere, every place, all at once. So it's just, I just want to let you all know, to showcase how much of a leader the DC Bar is in, you know, the law association and law society community. Really, you know, Bob spoke on a number of panels, you know, gave lessons learned from our DC Bar, examples of things that other bar associations can do based on what we do here at the DC Bar. So you should feel really proud that we are a leader in the nation in, you know, the legal field. So you are part of a select and a well-respected group. And I'm also happy to remind you all that this is the conference where this year, when we announced the Voluntary Bar Association of the Year at our celebration of leadership in June, we have decided that we are going to award that winning bar association to free registration to BLI, so that they can take, you know, whoever they'd like, their current president, their president-elect, their executive director, if they have one, and they can get the benefit of this great program. It is not inexpensive, so we think this will be a really, really nice additional benefit that we can provide to our voluntary bar association. So when we select that winning association and announce it, they will have that to look forward to. And then finally, a couple upcoming events I'd like to mention. Of course, we have our Bench Bar Conference that's coming up on Friday, the 28th of this month. Our theme, again, as we've talked about, is Home Rule at 50, looking back and looking forward. It should be a wonderful program. Many of our voluntary bars are speaking, have panels in the afternoon. So I really hope that many of you can make it. I think there is a voluntary registration, or there's a registration link for our Board of Governors members to register. Is that right? Yeah. And so hopefully if you haven't seen that, we can push that out to you after the meeting so that you can go ahead and go online and register, because we'd love to see as many of you here as possible. And I'm sorry, it's hard to decide where to look. The room, the screen. So I maybe look it all around. But we'd love to see you there. The judges have really spent a lot of time working on the program, making sure that we can put together some interesting speakers and panels. So I hope you make it. Also in the evening, we have our typical, as we typically do, our judicial reception, where we will honor judges who are taking senior status or retiring. And that's always a fun event. And then the very next day, I know it's a lot in 1 week, but we are going to have our Board of Governors Day at the Advice and Referral Clinic. So I hope a number of you already have signed up. So thank you very much for doing that. A number of you already have volunteered for the Pro Bono Center. So you already have gotten us that much further along to reaching 100% board participation in work at the Pro Bono Center. There is still time to sign up for our April clinic. Again, we'll push out that kind of sign up, and I think Anitra is the person to contact, and we'll push that out so you can reach out to her. You will have a choice of two kind of pre-training sessions on Zoom that you can attend that will kind of help you get ready for that Saturday. But it's a lot of fun. And if you can't make it that Saturday, there are two other dates for the Advice and Referral Clinic before we hit the end of this fiscal year in June. So we hope you can join us for one of those dates. I think it is, let's see. Of course, I had it written down here, and now it's May
27th.
May 27th and June 24th.
That's correct.
Yeah. And June 24th. And Kelly also has other, if Saturdays don't work for you, or you'd like to do something else, maybe along the immigration law field or perhaps in small business, we have clinics that you can volunteer for those. So Kelly can connect you up with any other opportunities. And please reach out to her if you just want to talk about, you know, what else is there out there that I can do to fulfill my obligation to volunteer for the Pro Bono Center. And I think one of the options that Kelly has is you can be a mentor. If you have expertise in one of the areas that we're looking for, you can serve as a mentor, and you can do that via Zoom. So you can do that from the comfort of your home. So Kelly, if you have if you have a list and want to talk to the group about what types of expertise you may be looking for, yeah, for our mentors.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Alan. Yeah. I also just wanted to mention that on June the 3rd, we have our immigration clinic. And so if you want to participate in the immigration clinic, you can. So we are looking for mentors in the following areas, and we'll also send an email out. But if you have expertise in bankruptcy, civil rights, consumer, employment, family, health, housing, sports, probate, public benefits, tax, or immigration. We would love for you to serve as a mentor. And as Dawn mentioned, you can do that in person or virtually at our clinic.
Great. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
And also, on the theme of the Pro Bono Center, along with our celebration of leadership, as you know, we precede that with the President's Reception, which honors our incoming President, Charles Lowry, and benefits the Pro Bono Center. So we hope that all of you will be there to support Charles and to support the Pro Bono Center. We'd love to see you there. We'd love to have you donate. That would be wonderful to, you know, whatever is within your means and you're comfortable with. We would love to have you participate in that way as well. And of course, our celebration of leadership follows that evening. We have some awards that have been determined, and I'm happy to tell you about them. Some we have yet to kind of caucus on and announce those, but our two kind of marquee awards. One is the B. Rosenberg Award, which goes to someone who has dedicated their career or a good portion of their career to service in the government, be it federal government, state, local. And also our William Brennan Award, which is to an individual who has done tremendous service in expanding civil rights and promoting civil rights and equal justice in our communities. So we're delighted to announce that our B. Rosenberg Award is Patricia McKenna. She is at the Department of Justice in their Environmental and Natural Resources section. She has obviously accepted, or I wouldn't be telling you, and we're very much looking forward to celebrating her award in June. And there will be, you know, press will be rolling out in the coming weeks about this. And also our William Brennan Award winner is John Belker, who is with Aaron Fox. He is a founding member of the Access to Justice Commission, and he has served for, I think, its existence as their legislative counsel. So he is one of the ones that is in the trenches, lobbying, you know, working with the government to make sure that the access to justice funding that we receive continues to flow into the district, to the DC Bar Foundation, so that it can be divided out in terms of grants to our legal services organizations, so we continue to provide legal services to those in our community who can't afford it. So we're very excited about those awards, and we have several more that will be on the way, and we will let you know as those get decided. And Sean, I see you have your hand up.
Just a scheduling thing. Thanks, Ellen. I know, I think that the celebration and the reception were originally scheduled for June 21st. But it's June 22nd. So I just want to make sure that was really clear for people's calendars.
Thank you very much for mentioning that, Sean. You're absolutely right. It was originally scheduled for the 22nd, and we have, so that was a Wednesday, and we have moved it 21st. Right. Sorry, it was originally scheduled for Wednesday, the 21st. It is now Thursday, the 22nd. So I hope that doesn't cause difficulties in scheduling for anyone. And we are looking forward to seeing as many of you that can make it there. And then finally, another upcoming event. As you know, we've talked about how excited we are about our CLE trip abroad to Scotland. We have, I think, Darren, is it almost 50 people?
No, we're still at the 30 range, but that's about to go up quite a bit because we have some big VIPs who really are interested in coming, including our own Ellen. and you know, we're getting some interest from the court now too, so. I'm not going to say more on that until it's finalized.
Right, exactly. We hope to have some exciting announcement, but we have some folks from the court that are interested in joining us. So we're really excited and hope to be able to announce their participation in the near future. But it should be a great event. I'm very much looking forward to it. I don't know if I'm a VIP, Darren, but I'm definitely looking forward to
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
and so I will be there, and I hope those of you, it seems a ways away, I know October, but plane flights and everything, you have to start thinking about it. So anyone who can join us, that would be terrific. We also have coming up some of our voluntary bar leadership group meetings. I want to thank all those members of the board who Zoomed in for the last voluntary bar leadership group meeting last month. It was a terrific program, and I do think the voluntary bar leaders really, really appreciated seeing members of our Board of Governors there, showing interest and showing support. We have two more voluntary bar leadership group meetings coming up for the rest of this year. They are both in person here at the bar. The first one is this month, Wednesday, the 26th. That'll be a lunch meeting at 12:15. We have great program lined up. Our past DC Bar president, Shirley Bucci, is going to be here. She has founded an interpretive center at Heart Mountain Internment Camp. For those of you who may know, Shirley's parents were interned at Heart Mountain when they were young. They met there. They subsequently, you know, married. And after her mom's death, Shirley really embraced kind of and got to know more about her heritage. She wrote a book about her mother and her family's history. And she helped to found this interpretive center. So Shirley is one of our speakers. We're also going to have our DC Bar marketing department, some of our folks talk about maximizing marketing efforts and how they can use social media to get their messages out and information about their events. And we're also going to have an update on the work of our DEI task force. So Esther Lim and Ben Wilson are going to be talking a little bit about what the task force has done so far and what they're expecting to do in the future. Unfortunately, neither one of them could be here in person, but they have recorded and I've heard them and seen them, some really fabulous remarks. So it'll be wonderful if you can make it for that meeting. And then kind of the marquee meeting, our last voluntary bar meeting of the year is in May. It's May 24th. These are both Wednesdays. We're shifting the time a little because we have a very special guest for that meeting. The time for the Wednesday, May 24th meeting will be 4 p.m. And our special guest is going to be our incoming ABA president, Mary Smith. So she's going to bring remarks. She'll be here. That last meeting is really just a reception for the voluntary bar leaders to socialize and talk about the year and plan for the future year. But Mary will be there. She is a DC Bar member, so we're very excited. But she'll be there, bring a few remarks, and then socialize with the group. So I hope you can be there. That's kind of our fun, our last meeting and our fun meeting for the year. And a couple other.
Yes. Did you say what time it is? Did you say what time it is?
Sure, 4 o'clock. That one's going to start at 4, so it'll be an afternoon reception, and that will be on the 8th floor, I believe. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. And then just a few announcements before we move on to business. First of all, I wanted to bring everyone up to date on what's the recent developments with access to justice funding. Many of you may know the mayor's budget came out several weeks ago, and it included a drop in funds that had been allocated for the Access to Justice Initiative. Last year, we had a record 31 million funds that were going to Access to Justice. This year, the mayor's budget has cut that by 60%. So we're down to 14 million. So that is a significant cut. It goes without saying that the Access to Justice Commission, Nancy Drain, their executive director, the legal services community, the bar, you know, we are mobilized. We are exploring all avenues of what we can do to increase that funding. It's in part a function of the fact that revenues are down for the district, tax revenues. So, you know, the mayor is looking to save money where she can. She unfortunately chose to cut a significant amount from the Access to Justice Initiative. So the goal going forward is to make sure that we can try to restore as much of that funding as possible. We are fortunate that the DC Council Chair, Phil Mendelson, is a friend. He very much believes in the importance of the Access to Justice Initiative and how vital this funding is for our community. So we are counting on his support. We are also exploring different ways to try to get the message across. As we have done in the past, the President and President-elect, Charles and I, have authored a letter that will be sent to the council that we have solicited our past presidents to sign on to, that stresses how important this funding is and that, you know, it should be restored to last year's levels. The chief judges and I are working on an op-ed that we hope will be published in the Post that will again, you know, make the case for restoring access to justice funding. And on Thursday, the council committee that focuses on social justice and it's the Office of Victim Services and Justice Grants, I think. They are having a hearing all day on Thursday. Many members of the legal services community will be testifying, including Nancy Drain, who is the executive director of the Access to Justice Commission. And I will be testifying as well. Kira Jarrett, who is the executive director of the DC Bar Foundation. So, you know, we're putting a full court press out We're hopeful that we will get some of that funding restored, whether we get all of it restored or not. I think it remains to be seen. But so that's a major initiative that we have going on this week. And I just wanted the Board of Governors to be aware of that. Questions on that? Then just a couple more announcements. Excited to say that our young lawyers community, which may have a different name, we had the meeting of our first working group to put together kind of the parameters of the community, what the programming might look like. That group decided that young lawyers community might be a little too narrow, because the idea is that the programming for this group will be, for folks who may have, this may be their second career, and so they're back, or maybe they have, they've had their bar license for a while, but they did something else with it. Maybe they went into business with it, and now they're coming back and they want to practice. So to be more encompassing, the idea that, or the name that currently is on the table is Early Career Lawyers Community, which may be a mouthful, but we've shortened it to ECLC. But it's very exciting. There's some great ideas for partnering with the Pro Bono Center for this group, for working with the Lawyer Assistance Program, so that we make sure the wellness initiatives that our LAP program is working on with our local law schools get carried on for our lawyers, when our young lawyers, when they become practicing as associates or in other employment settings. And the exciting thing is we will have this community as an option when the license renewals come out May 1. So we're very much looking forward to getting this off the ground. We have a great group of really excited folks, really from all experience levels and different voluntary bars. So this will be very exciting. And I know many of you here on the Board of Governors have volunteered to be on that working group. So thank you very much for your input and your expertise. And then two final, I think, announcements. One is kind of a sad one. Many of you may have known one of our DC Bar past presidents, George Jones. He passed away last month. We don't have a lot of information about it, but we were notified by a colleague of his. So we're just keeping our eyes open and ears to the ground for any more information that we have on it. And then two really happy things we'd like to celebrate with good friends. One of our Board of Governors members, Fatima Marchik, has been named the office managing partner for the DC office of her firm, Shepherd Mullen. So Fatima, we're so excited for you.
Thank you.
And then some fun news with respect to a former Board of Governors member of ours that I think we all know pretty well, and who is our designee on the Access to Justice Commission. Paul Lee was at Steptoe and Johnson. He has made partner, and really the first partner who has devoted his career to pro bono fully. So congratulations to Paul. We're very proud of you. And those are all the announcements and kind of business I have right now. So if there are no questions on any of that, I see a couple of chats, but maybe they're just congratulations. I'll look at them. Okay. Then let's move to the consent agenda. So the only item on the consent agenda we have are the minutes of our March board meeting. If I hear no, are there any objections or corrections to the minutes? All right, then I'm going to consider the consent agenda approved. And Bob, we'll now turn to you for our CEO's report.
Right. On the operations of the bar, we're still operating on a hybrid basis, but we have an increasing number of in-person and hybrid meetings. The building is getting busier each week, and as you heard from Ellen, we've been hosting a number of larger programs, including last week's Constitution in the Classroom program. Last week, we also had a program for the United States Courts. It was called Roadways to the Bench. Who me? It was the second national diversity event for law students and attorneys to learn about bankruptcy and magistrate judge positions and how you can get yourself there. It was a logistical challenge, to say the least. We had 150 people in the building, which doesn't sound like that many, but we live streamed to more than 2,000 people in three dozen locations in little breakout groups. So it took, as Stacy pointed out, like I think five or six prep meetings to get it all working, but everything went flawlessly. And they were thrilled. So we were really, really excited to be able to do that. Speaking of successful programs, I'd like to turn to Dennis Cuevas, the head of our CLE program, to talk about a new program we are launching.
That's right. So the CLE program, we're really excited. We are launching our paralegal and legal assistant training program. It starts this April 21st. The program consists of three full day in-person sessions here at the bar. First one again, April 21st. The second one will be on May 19th, and the third one will be held June 23rd. The program will cover legal writing, legal research, discovery, e-discovery, case management systems, the anatomy of a case and the litigation process, negotiation, and ethics. In addition to the core curriculum, registrants will be able to select a track of specially bundled on-demand courses in specific practice areas, such as criminal law, employment law, IP, and many others to supplement their core education. The last day we'll have a reception and presentation of completion certificates. All told, the program is 15 hours of instruction in person, as well as up to 8 hours of on-demand programming. Interest in the program has been very high. So we initially thought we would have a cohort of 20 to 25 paralegals. As of today, we have 40 who have signed up. We have another dozen in the system who have yet to complete the registration, and we still have another week of registration to go. So I think when all is said and done, we'll have between 60 to 65 or 70 people signed up for the paralegal program. We've had a number of organizations do group registration. So we've had a couple of government agencies, the Department of Labor, Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, Amtrak, as well as a couple of law firms, Cohen Milstein and Stern Kessler, register several people for the program. And the information can be found on our website. We are closing registration at 5 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time on Wednesday, April 19th. So we're going to try and get as many people as we possibly can. I think we've been fielding a lot of phone calls and a lot of emails. We are recording this session for those who may not be able to make an in-person session, but they are encouraged to attend, you know, the program in full. So that's, yeah, we're really excited about it. And I think, you know, we'll be offering this every year until, you know, until demand is not as hot.
Great. And this is actually a great example of how we learn from other bar associations as well, because we heard this idea last year. It was actually at the summer meeting, wasn't it?
Summer
meeting. And so we came back thinking, we could do that. And so we basically said to Dennis, can't you do that? And so it's an amazing accomplishment. They put together this fabulous program, got this interest, have all these people signed up. And, you know, and once again, it's a great example of how nimble we can be. No pun intended. That's the name of our association management system, which is not exactly nimble, but to go ahead and get it all together. So it was really good.
And what's special about the program is many of the sessions will be taught jointly by paralegals and experienced attorneys. So that perspective is not going to get lost. We heard during the planning of the program from many paralegals that, you know, please don't just get attorneys to lecture at us. Like, we get that every day. So and so, you know, we have quite a number of paralegals who will be actually instructors for the program. We're excited about it.
Right. Just so that you know, we did receive a letter from the New Jersey State Bar Association asking us to support a bill that's before the Senate. It's called the Sunshine Protection Act, which seeks to make daylight savings time permanent. The New Jersey State Bar Association is taking a position in support of the measure, which they're billing as an attorney wellness matter. We, of course, responded to them. We support, obviously, attorney wellness and law student wellness, judicial wellness, but that we are constrained about what we can do when it comes to lobbying or advocating for specific legislation. So they appreciated our position on that. DC candidates, the candidates forum. So as you know, the slate of candidates for the 2023 elections is out. Elections are going to run between April 28th and June 1st. And on May 3rd, we will be holding an in-person candidates forum here at the bar where the president-elect candidates will have an opportunity to address the members and all candidates will be able to be there and network. We're inviting all members with special invitations going out to our voluntary bars, our communities, and our community members. So it'll be the first time we've held this in person since 2019, and we're very much looking forward to it. And then finally, I just wanted to respond to a question that came up at our last meeting when we were discussing the budget about late fees and the demographics of those who are most likely to pay late or the ones who are paying late most often. I think the question was framed in a way that maybe thought that perhaps it was our younger members that were actually paying late most often and then having late fees, but that is not the case. The average age of the people paying late fees is 54, with an average tenure of 23 years. And in fact, our youngest and newest members are the least likely to pay late among the group. So just want to make sure I circled back on that and let you know. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I will turn it back over to Alan.
Any questions for Bob? All right. Well, Bob, thank you so much for that report. And Dennis, thank you so much for that amazing program that you put together. I think that will be great. And what a great service to our community. So thank you. All right. We are going to hear from Rob Weiner. I don't know if he's here. Yes, he's on. Oh, he is. Great. Rob, it's good to see you. Thank you for joining us today. We are so pleased to have you with us, and we are looking forward to hearing from you a report on the 2023 ABA mid-year meeting.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. First, let me say that George Jones was general counsel of the bar when I was president, and he was a great general counsel. He was a great president of the bar and a really, really fine human being who did an enormous amount for pro bono and for the bar, and he will be sorely missed. Turning to the ABA, the ABA had its mid-year meeting. It was a one-day session for the House of Delegates on March 6th, and it covered a lot of territory. Let me start, since this is a bar, with the issues concerning regulation of the profession. It was a resolution that passed 604, which encouraged state and territorial bar licensing entities to eliminate any questions about gender identity or sexual orientation, and to eliminate processes that would inadvertently lead to disclosure of gender identity without the explicit consent of the applicant. There was also a resolution offered by the Legal Education Committee to eliminate the requirement for law schools to use the LSAT or its equivalent. That resolution failed. It did not pass. A resolution passed opposing adoption of standards of practice for professional conduct of attorneys before federal agencies, except the exception is consistent with the rules of professional conduct and for practice in adjudicative proceedings insofar as necessary to maintain order. There was a resolution 400 that passed urging the adoption of a code of conduct for the Supreme Court, which recent events have made particularly relevant right now. And there were two resolutions addressed to judges. One, asking judges to encourage participation by young lawyers in court proceedings. And a second, asking judges to eliminate symbols of the Confederacy from courthouses. In Giles County, Tennessee, for example, there is a room for jurors and grand jurors to deliberate in called the Confederacy Room, with all sorts of symbols of the Confederacy and pictures of Jefferson Davis. I'm sure that there are, it is of, it is important to some of the individuals who deliberate in those rooms. The other resolutions that passed, one sought to protect their right to travel from state to state in seeking medical care. And another resolution, which was unexpectedly controversial, was to put the ABA on record condemning anti-Semitism. There was a definition of anti-Semitism that was offered in the resolution, definition from the International Holocaust Remembrance Council that some people interpreted as making opposition to Israel a form of anti-Semitism. The resolution explicitly disclaimed that, but rather than argue about it, the sponsors of the resolution eliminated the definition. And so it's that avoided the controversy and the resolution passed. So those are the highlights. I'm sure there are other there are others I could talk about. There may be others in which members of this board are interested, and I'm happy to address any questions.
Thank you very much, Rob. Does anyone have any questions for Rob on any of the proposals he discussed or any others that may have come before the Board of Delegates? All right, well, thank you very much, Rob. As always, sure. We appreciate your thorough report and for representing us so ably in the House of Delegates.
Thank you, it's a pleasure.
Thank you. All right, and now I think on our agenda is, we have folks coming in. We have a report of our Rules of Professional Conduct Review Committee. And I see we have Hope Todd with us. And Stephen Marcus?
Yes, hello.
Hello, and do you, are others from your delegation joining us, or is it just you?
Yes, I believe that Liz Simon and Herman Gomez. Herman Gomez is our chair, and Liz Simon is the vice chair of the Rules Review Committee.
I am checking right now to see if they're on screen.
I saw you.
Yes, I see Herman. Yep. Herman, welcome. We're glad to have you.
Thank you.
And I see, I think I see Elizabeth as well.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Great. Elizabeth, thank you so much. Welcome. We appreciate you being here with us. And Steve and Hope, we appreciate you being here in person as well. So thank you very much, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. The Rules Committee is recommending that Rule 1.15 be revised. That it be revised to reflect some opinions of the DC Court of Appeals dealing with how lawyers must treat flat or fixed fees that they receive from clients. If I could have the first slide put up, I'll give you a summary, what we're recommending before we actually dive into the specifics. So the first thing we're recommending is that a flat or fixed fee, by the way, flat and fixed fees basically mean the same thing. I tried to figure out the difference. There isn't a difference between a flat or a fixed fee. A flat fee and a fixed fee basically means a set fee by the lawyer at the outset of the representation for the services the lawyer is going to provide. Flat or fixed fee is an advance fee, and it's got to go into trust. That's what was the holding of a case decided in 2009 called In Re Nance. So, secondly, in order for the lawyer not to put a flat or fixed fee into trust, the lawyer needs client's informed consent, and specifically that consent must be confirmed. And that's the holding of a case called Parnes, which we'll talk about. And then finally, Rule 1.5, which is the rule that most lawyers look at when they're looking at their obligations, ethical obligations with respect to fees, has a note or a comment that references unearned fees or advance fees. We thought it prudent to put in a cross-reference to our amended rules so that lawyers who want to know the full extent of their ethical duties when it comes to advance fees go to this amended rule and understand what it requires. Now, some background and a little bit of legal history. Before 2000, Rule 1.15 stated that an advance fee was the property of the lawyer, and many lawyers followed that practice. That when the advance fee came in, they didn't put it into their trust account, they put it into their operating account. But the rule was revised in 2000 to require that an advance fee be treated as the property of the client, not the lawyer, which meant that it had to go into trust, unless the client gave informed consent. The rule itself, the amendment, didn't clarify what about fixed fees or flat fees. Were they going to be treated as an advance fee? That issue was decided by the court in 2009 in a case called Henry Mass. And the holding of that case was that in defining the term advance fee, it includes a flat or a fixed fee. In addition, Mans also laid out several disclosures that a lawyer needs to make in order to get the client's informed consent, to make sure that the client's consent truly was informed if the lawyer wanted to treat the fee, the flat fee, as the lawyer's property and not the default provision, which is that it's the client's property. Interestingly, in the opinion itself, the court said, we're confident that the bar, Board of Governors, will provide legal education to lawyers so that they understand their ethical duties when it comes to flat fees. And so it went for many, many years. The bar has provided extensive legal education to lawyers about in re mens to explain to them when they receive a flat fee, the money goes into trust unless they get their client's informed consent. But regrettably, not all lawyers have adhered to that education. And some of them have been brought before the board on professional responsibility and been disciplined. Last year, the DC Court of Appeals decided in Re R. And it said in that case that it was the implication of the case was the court was surprised that we hadn't actually revised Rule 1.15 to reflect the court's holding in Mans. The court said the rule still has not been updated to reflect Mans. So we, the Rules Committee, read that to mean that was a not so subtle message. But we had to revise the rule, and apparently the court had changed its mind about legal education, and now what it wanted. The rule amendment. So, under Hope's very skillful leadership, we began the work of revising Rule 1.15 to reflect the court's holding in Mans. While we were going about that, the court decided another case called In re Pons. And In re Pons, the court said that in order to get informed consent in this context of treating the advance fee as the lawyer's property, informed consent had to be in writing, which, by the way, the rule does not require a writing, had to be in writing. And also those disclosures I mentioned that were referenced or mentioned in the Mans case, the lawyer had to make those disclosures to the client so that about the risks and so forth involved in what it meant, so that the client's informed consent is truly informed. So at that point, our committee broadened its scope of work, and we decided to revise Rule 1.15 to reflect both what the court had directed us to do in Har, but also the requirement stated in Pons that informed consent must be in writing, and that we had to include in the rule or the comment to the rule the requirement of the disclosures discussed in the next case. So there are really kind of three reasons why we're coming to you with this proposal. First, I think we've been told we have to because of course, it's important place. Second of all, we want to make sure that we're doing a good job educating lawyers and so that they understand their legal obligations. And in so doing, hopefully we'll be less likely to be subject to this. And the third reason is There was a lot of concern when the court decided PONS that here was a rule that didn't require an informed consent be in writing. And now the court was saying it had to be in writing. And that we had a worry that this might be kind of an opening to the court to look at other places in the rules where there's no writing requirement for informed consent and to make a similar holding and then find put lawyers in a position where they unknowingly got what they thought was informed consent but didn't get it in writing. So we wanted the comment to make it clear that this writing requirement was restricted to flat or advanced. So that's the background. If we could go to the next slide and we'll show you. Oh, thank you. So this is the actual rule, and what's highlighted in red are our recommended amendments. So you've got advances of unearned fees. We're now going to include within that term flat or fixed fees. That's Nance. And second of all, you can treat the advance fee as a lawyer's property as long as the client gives informed consent, but it must be confirmed in writing. That's PONS. You go to the next slide, please. The next slide, we are, first of all, just citing Nance for the authority for the proposition that informed consent, that an advance fee includes a flat or a fixed fee, requiring informed consent to treat it otherwise. That's Nance. And if we go to the next slide, please. The most significant part here is the last sentence, which says that when a lawyer is getting an agreement with the client with respect to advance fees, it would be prudent for the lawyer to identify specific milestones so that the lawyer and the client understand at what point in time the lawyer can treat the fees as his or her own. And I should have mentioned, by the way, and this comment reminds me of it, is that we actually went through a public comment process and we received 5 sets of comments, one from the Board of Professional Responsibility, that was actually one of their recommendations. We received comments from the Office of Discipline Counsel, and they all agreed that we should amend the rule, and they made 3 recommended changes, all of which we've incorporated into the comments. And then the next slide, please. This is an entirely new comment, comment 10, which citing man says that in order to get informed consent, it has to be in writing. And then I mentioned earlier that man's has these factors or disclosures that must be made in order to make sure the client's consent is informed. And there you can see we've identified them. If you want to just take a minute and hold that slide, you can see what those factors are. We've got 4 there, and then I'd then turn to the last slide. Thank you. So the last slide has the 5th factor. And then we also, this last sentence reflects another recommendation from the Board of Professional Responsibility, which was, I thought, a very good one, which is that the client should be aware that in agreeing to let the lawyer treat the advance fee as the lawyer's property, the client takes a risk. And the risk is that the lawyer may not have funds such time as the representation is terminated. At that point, the client is entitled to a refund of the unearned fees, but it's possible the lawyer could face a judgment. There could be a writ of attachment on the lawyer's bank account, and the funds may not be there. The client should know that. So that's an additional risk in addition to the 5 risk factors or factors mentioned. So we're recommending that this be approved by the Board of Governors.
Thank you very much for that very thorough and easy to understand explanation. Are there any questions?
Hi, Cheyenne Tabuti. In terms of the informed consent, I work for a pro bono organization, so we don't charge. But my experience with informed consent, and I 100% agree with the notion of what do we mean by informed consent? Do we have enough disclosures in that writing for the client to understand that it's not just simply the matter of, hey, I'm the lawyer, I'm going to keep your money in my business account, and anything unearned, I'll return it back to you. And kudos to the committee in terms of breaking them into separate parts and what is sufficient disclosure. Do you foresee, I mean, I 100% agree with what a disclosure should be, but do we foresee, in terms of helping lawyers understand with this change, sort of coming up with a template of what would be a sufficient writing that touches all the five main elements of disclosure? Because, you know, we are talking about, you know, small law firms, young lawyers who may not be, you know, so informed about changes in rules and regulations, solo practitioners. And I think that would be very useful for them to understand, hey, these are the changes, but in addition to changes, we are giving you a template, what is would be a sufficient informed consent. And then also, in terms of in writing, you know, we all use emails, right? Would an email containing these five disclosures be sufficient in terms of informed writing? Does it have to be on paper? Does it have to be signed by ink by the client? Or can all the five elements of disclosure should be an email and sent to the client, and the client reads it and email back to me and says, yes, I agree. That does that qualify as the client giving informed consent? So my point was, you know, having that sort of subsequent like template that we can come up and so be useful for, especially for young lawyers, I think that would be to ensure that compliance with the rule is, you know, is done by lawyers.
I think it's a very important question, and I would go beyond that a little bit and say that I think the bar not only should provide a template, I think it would be good for the bar to provide legal education. Because we are, in an attempt to help lawyers, also creating obligations that lawyers have not had before, which is the disclosures required by the court. So I would agree with you that having a template that could be used by lawyers to make sure that kind of covers the at least the minimum requirements, and incorporating that into continuing legal education so that lawyers really understand kind of what we're doing would be very, very important. So yes. In terms of an email versus a letter, it's a writing. So I think it's fine. And there's no requirement that it be signed by the client, although I would suggest, I think the prudent lawyer, in order to make sure that you can never challenge whether the client's consent was informed, I think as a matter of just good practice, if not ethical requirement, advisable to have the client.
And I also would add that I deal with many people that English is not their, I mean, English is not my first language. In the immigrants community, people who, and often there are a lot of immigration law firms that they do advanced fees. And I think that's one industry that will change the way they practice would be this changing rule, because I've witnessed a lot of people that, you know, clients that they give advance fee, but advance fee is in the operating business of the lawyer. But also you have this challenge of, does the client really understand what you're saying in that informed consent? And is that document being translated to that client's native language? So I think that would be also a challenge that would come into play in terms of changing the.
I agree, that's one of the issues we wrestled with as a committee. How do you know that the client is actually giving consent?
Right.
The lawyer makes the disclosure. You've seen many letters, engagement letters, and the client signs it. But does the client really understand it? Right. Oftentimes not. So I think it does put a burden on the lawyer. And to your point, translations may be necessary to make sure that it'll, and you're right, not just immigration, criminal law is another place where lawyers often get flat fees. So the clients may not really understand some of these fine details. It's going to be on the lawyer able to make sure they get the consent that they need. And that's, I think, where legal education is pretty critical.
Thank you for your work.
Thank you for those excellent questions, Cheyenne and Steve, for your responses. Looks like Natalie, you have a question as well or comment?
Yes, I just had a couple questions. Thank you, Ellen. I wasn't sure if I heard the entirety of the explanation about the second section of this particular slide, starting with as part of obtaining informed consent, and what that section specifically was meant to solve with respect to with the underlying decisions and sort of the clarity that it sought there. If you could just give a little bit more description on that piece. Thank you.
Sure, happy to. So when a lawyer puts money in their trust in their trust account, it's protected from creditors. And so the lawyer's economic fate is irrelevant to the protection of the client funds. But if the lawyer transfers the client's money into his or her operating account, that's the lawyer's property. And if the lawyer runs into some financial problem, say, and there is a judgment obtained against the lawyer and a writ of attachment, some collection device is used, giving the creditor priority or claim, that claim will come ahead of the client's right to a return of the money at the termination of the representation. So the client needs to know that if they're going to consent to the lawyer treating the property as their own property, they take the risk that at such time if the representation is terminated and there's money left that hasn't been earned, the rules require that money be returned to the client. But the client may not be able to recover it if it's subject to attachment by a creditor or some other claim that stands ahead of the client's claim. Does that answer the question?
Yes, I think it, you know, in my practice, I would certainly be extremely careful about, unearned fees. I think a lot of attorneys, if it's not earned, it just doesn't go into operating. And that's, I think, where I'm trying to understand is how would that money even make it into an operating account to begin with?
Because so many lawyers have done this historically and treated as their property until the rule was changed. So it can be done. The default provision is that no, it's the client's property, but the lawyer can get the client through its conformed consent to agree to the transfer. But what we're saying is you have to comply with disclosure requirements in order to make that possible. And the client could refuse.
Thank you. And just to follow up on that, how does this language or even in the underlying case law mirror or maybe diverge from Maryland and Virginia?
I'm going to ask Hope's the Maryland and Virginia expert.
Oh, I don't know the answer to that question. Maryland and Virginia, not sure. I don't know that they have. This has really been in some ways a unique DC problem, because of the sort of strict liability that arises under the jurisprudence regarding handling client fees and DC tends to, if it's $1, if it's commingled, automatic 6-month suspension. If it's $1 and it goes below the trust account, automatic disbarment. It's really a very high and hard standard. And so we have a little bit more development in this area of law, I think, than in Virginia and Maryland. I think both of them have the ability to put advance fees in trust with informed consent, but I don't know that they don't have the In re Nance case. So I don't know the jurisprudence in either jurisdiction. So I'm sorry, I can't really answer your question.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
I can give you a little preview of something else that we're working on. Because to Hope's point, DC is a very restrictive jurisdiction. And I think there are many cases involving misappropriation and commingling. And many lawyers have found themselves subject to presumptive of suspension for 6 months, even though they've used their best efforts to avoid it. We're working on a safe harbor rule that would protect the lawyer who follows best practices from being subject to discipline. Precisely because the court has been very, very tough on lawyers. And many lawyers have faced disbarment and suspension for these kinds of ethical violations?
Thank you for that question, Natalie, and for the responses. I see we have two more questions. Let's, Diane, go to Diane first, and then Courtney.
Yeah, thank you.
Sally, we'll get you to Sally, although we need to funnel it.
I don't know if it's changed because it wouldn't matter to me, but I, as long as I've been a member of the Maryland Bar, if it's not an earned fee, it has to stay in trust. And then the issue became when DC allowed you to have it in operating, but Maryland didn't, which rule do you follow? And for me, and I think everyone I know, it was a no-brainer. You just go with the more restrictive rule. It's not your money. It, you know, you didn't earn it. So I think when DC allows this, people who practice in multiple jurisdictions should be aware that that's a little more permissive. I understand this language. I just wonder who it is. I mean, if we're trying to protect the client, then the right way to do it is keep it in trust. And I would love to see language that says as part of informing consent, you're talking about the benefit of it being in trust as well as the risk of, or maybe instead of the risk of it not. Like if someone said to me, well, why would you keep it in trust? I'd say, well, because it's a protected account. It's not my money. It's not my taxpayer identification number. Creditors can't attach it. You're safe. And if it's in my operating account, which like I said, on a personal level, I don't think it should be, so that there is no risk to the client. I think this would scare the client and maybe rightly so, but why aren't we also just putting in maybe one sentence about the benefit of putting it in trust, putting it in a positive light? Because if we're really trying to protect the client, they should know the advantage of it being in a trust account as well as the risk of it not.
Well, it's an interesting point. One of the comments we received, which made the argument that for many lawyers, particularly small practitioners, there's a benefit to the lawyer in being able to treat an advance fee as the property of the lawyer. I mean, there are multiple interests here at stake, and it could well put some lawyers in a difficult financial position if the sort of the requirement was that advance fees only be put into trust, or there was just a rule that clearly was aimed in that direction. So I think you're right to raise, you know, that the client's interests here would suggest that it be kept in trust. But on the other hand, there may be cases that the client, you know, where the client couldn't find a lawyer other than a lawyer who actually requires that the funds be transferred. So one unintended consequence of what you're suggesting, I'm just kind of imagining this, could be fewer lawyers available to help clients. And so I think there are multiple interests here. And I think the rule really is designed to reflect them, but with full disclosure.
Okay. I mean, I've always been solo. I don't know. I just feel like I'm not the one part of the Washington Lawyer Magazine I never want to be on is bar counsel's page or necessary counsel's page. And the ones you see are the ones who, you know, don't communicate or commingle or you know, take money before it's earned. So sometimes I never thought about it that the lawyer that you might get to work for you is the one who wants the money before they've earned it. And it's an interesting perspective. So I just was thinking, why don't we fully inform them? Here's the risk, but here's the advantage so that they're making a decision that's right for them. But and I'm not criticizing the very hard work. Please never take it that way. I just was trying to balance it a little more. But I'll be quiet. We'll hear other people speak. I'm done.
Well, thank you, Diane, for that excellent question. And Courtney, I think you had your hand up next.
Yeah, hi. To me, the trickiest part of this is that with a flat fee, when does it become earned? It might be that that's addressed in one of the cases, but it seems like that creates the larger difficulty here.
I think it's going to be somewhat challenging for lawyers to think that through. There are several milestones that we reference in the comment. One could be completion of specific tasks. Another could be the passage of time. And there could be some other milestone. The rule doesn't really tell you what they should be, but other than to say you should have milestones. And that could be another place in which the bar should provide legal education to think about what's a reasonable milestone for a lawyer to include in an engagement letter, so that client and the lawyer. That's fair to address the earlier question. It's fair to both sides, so that the lawyer isn't paying himself or herself until some reasonable milestone that reflects the money being, you know, paid is reached.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Courtney. Sally, I think, did you have a question?
Mine is not nearly as complicated as anyone else's. I just wanted to note that in the documents, sometimes the people who commented are referred to as commenters ER and some with an OR. So I think it should be corrected.
Thank you for that.
Thank you, Sally. Always important to have a close eagle eye on these.
Yes, if we're purporting to give advice, best to have it at least grammatically, whatever, correct.
Absolutely. And just for folks' clarification, we will not be voting to approve at this meeting. You know, this is the meeting where it is first presented, and then we'll be voting at the June. And Janine had some questions. Her microphone isn't working, so she has them in the chat, and let me ask them. These are from our board member, Janine Jackson. The first question is, must you inform the client in writing and verbally? And the second, I can go back, is it appropriate to bill the client monthly for work earned under this rule? So I'll go back to the first one again. Must you inform the client in writing and verbally?
The answer is yes. That's Mance.
Okay, that's Mance. So clear answer to that question.
Yeah.
That's also in the language of the proposed comment.
Okay, great. And then second question, is it appropriate to bill the client monthly for work earned under this rule?
I don't know whether you could answer that question without having facts. I mean, there's nothing in the rule or the comment, rather, that would prohibit it. But you do want a meaningful relationship between the work and the fees. And if nothing's happening, one might have a question, is that appropriate? So, but on the other hand, you know, depending on the work complexity to the representation in terms of perhaps the lawyer is just agreed to be available as needed to the client, and therefore monthly seems reasonable. So I don't think it would be prohibited. But you know, that's going to be something that we're all going to have to kind of figure out for ourselves as we're coming up with these. But the rule doesn't really give you that guidance. It just says it's good to have milestones, one of which could be the passage of time, whether it's monthly or quarterly. I think would depend on the circumstances.
And then Janine's added something I'm not sure I understand. Is it appropriate to bill the client monthly for work earned under this rule for flat or advanced? I'm not sure I quite know the difference there. Maybe just keep
getting. I think I'm hearing the same question.
Yeah, I think it's kind of the same. Yeah. So whether it's whether it's flat, advanced, or whatever, you're saying it will depend on the facts.
Yeah.
And you want to really tie it to what, how much is actually earned.
Correct.
Thank you very much. Sure. Any other questions?
One last question. This has been the spirit of this change is clarifying to DC lawyers that this has been the rule. This is not, we're not reinventing the wheel. So there's no concern about retroactive application of prior conduct when the rule is amended, because the principle was in place. We're just making it more clear what this rule is.
Correct. But what we're doing is we're stating the obligation, the ethical duty in a rule rather than having to look at a case.
Right.
So that there'll be greater clarity, hopefully, and knowledge to lawyers about what their obligations are. Doesn't change the law.
Doesn't change. Thank you.
And actually doing so really at the behest of the court, who kind of said, we think you should do this. This would be a good idea. All right. Any final questions? Well, thank you so much, Stephen Hope. We really appreciate you being here. We appreciate Herman and Elizabeth being on the Zoom call with us, and we definitely appreciate all the fabulous work that this committee does for the bar. It's irreplaceable and invaluable. So thank you so much. And be sure to, if you are hungry, grab some food on your way out. Please, there's plenty. And staff and board members who are here, feel free to get up and grab some food, get some lunch. We have plenty of easy to eat and easy to carry food as well as plates. My homemade muffins. Cheyenne's been the best advertisement for the muffins, and he also brought some very luscious looking donuts. So I think we are now to our general counsel update. So, you know,
yep.
Get away.
Thank you, Ellen. And this is just meant to be a very brief, high level preview of what the board will receive at its June meeting. We're still kind of working through the details and getting various updates and changes through the respective committees. But I just wanted to kind of give everyone a heads up that on the bylaws, which their revision was passed almost a year ago to this date, now that we've been kind of living and working with them over the last 10 months, and we've noticed some editorial and clarifying changes that we'd like to propose. We'll submit it to the Regs Rules for Governance Committee and have those ready for the board to review. I'd say about 90 to 95% of the changes are mostly editorial and clarifying. The one probably most substantive change is looking to, again, just clarify the language we have surrounding term limits for board members. We'll propose some language to make it clear that if a board member, whether they were elected or appointed as a non-voting member, their two-term limit would be not inclusive of any partial terms they served previously. So if somebody stepped in and was appointed to fill a vacancy, that time wouldn't count against the two-term limit. So we're just kind of working through the details of that language. I've consulted with Nancy Sylvester, who's been invaluable throughout the process to make sure any changes that we're making don't do any damage to the work that had been done over the several months leading up to the revision. So that's on the bylaws. And on the procurement and contracting policy, again, this is a document that on the staff side, at least, and on the bar side, we've been living and working with over the last 3 or 4 years. So again, there'll be some substantive and also editorial changes, really to clarify the process that's on paper to match reality. Some of the substantive changes will include adding discretion and authority for the CIO, the executive director of the Pro Bono Center, and then also the executive attorney, and I don't know Phil Fox's title, but over at ODC, for them to have some authority to enter contracts up to a limited amount. It's a relatively modest threshold. There's some more clarity in that now that there is an in-house general counsel. We've clarified language there. There is no longer a purchasing officer at the bar, so anything related to that now defunct position is being stricken. And one other change that you'll see is the board some time ago, I think it certainly predates me, had instituted a policy where the CEO was authorized to enter certain contracts. Under the policy overall, the COO is generally the only person who can enter into contracts on behalf of the bar. The board, probably in 2019, I think, created a carve out where the CEO would have limited authority. So now we've taken that language on this kind of extraneous policy that was flying out in the ether and incorporated that into the larger procurement and contract policy. Again, it's an effort to streamline and get relevant rules in one place rather in multiple places. And those are the kind of previews I have. I'm happy to answer any questions based on that.
Thank you, Adam. Any questions for Adam on these changes that may be coming down for us to review? All right, seeing no hands, Adam, I think we will stay with you for discussion of the proposed charters and an action item if the board's ready to vote.
Sure, thanks, Ellen. So we've provided in your materials a brief memo that outlines kind of the process and substance of what is before you. Rather than repeat what's in the memo, what I'd like to do, if it's okay with Ellen and the board, is to kind of just take one charter at a time. And if anyone had particular questions, for example, the audit budget, we could take them in turn and maybe discuss each charter. As you know, all of them have kind of gone through the committee process, and so they're here before the board to consider. So if that's fine, I'd like to proceed that way, just in the interest of efficiency and time.
How does that sound to the board? I mean, one other way is if there, we could just pick out, if the board has certain questions on certain charters, we could just pick out and go through those.
Yeah, I didn't mean that I would walk through particular charters. We could ask if folks have questions on the audit committee charter, and then just kind of hopefully take them on one by one.
All right, that sounds good.
So I'll just go in alphabetical order. Are there any questions related to the audit committee charter? Or the budget committee charter?
And just to clarify for everyone, these charters in draft form were sent out to all the members of the respective committees, and so everyone had an opportunity in that committee to comment, suggest changes, and then they were revised and formally approved by that respective committee, and now in front of the board for approval.
So audit, budget, the CLE committee, luckily we've got Dennis here with them too. The now renamed governance committee. Investment committee. Judicial evaluation committee. The Leadership Development Committee. Nominations Committee. Pension Committee. And last but not least, Sally, sorry, go ahead, Sally.
Yeah, I have a question about the screening committee membership. I'm not sure I understand why there are four voting members and one non-voting member. So if we're looking for a recommendation from this committee, are we apt to have a 2-2 split without really knowing what the committee's preferences and not understanding why there's a non-voting member? It's just a question.
Thanks, Sally. And I apologize. I didn't catch that the one non-voting would then leave us with four board members would have a vote. But the one non-voting member is kind of a carryover from the existing composition of the screening committee. And so we kept that in the interest of kind of having that public member benefit and that perspective as part of the group that would be making these considerations and recommendations.
So the non-voting member is a member of the public as opposed to a bar member?
Bob was whispering in my ear. Go ahead. Can you ask the question again, Bob?
Yes. So the non-voting member is not a lawyer. It's a member of the community.
No. So the non-voting member is one of the board members who are not voting, for example, June. But Bob clarified that when it comes to the committee, everyone has a vote in the committee. So we would still have five people who are voting. So what we could do is clarify that the one non-voting member is from the board but has a vote on the committee.
I see. Yeah, that, yeah, I think a clarification would be in order on that. Thank you.
Sure, thank you. Thank you, Sally, for that question, because I blew by that as well. Mm-hmm. So thank you for your precise reading. We very much appreciate it.
There was a lot of math that went into all of these to make sure that we avoided that problem as possible.
That's why we have a great board.
Can I just mention, no, and Sally, and so this is when, like, see how lawyers read the same thing differently. I thought because we're too smart to have a 2-2 tie situation that maybe the immediate past president didn't vote. Then there were three voting members and then there's non-voting member. And that, so like, I was like, okay, that I wouldn't have brought it up because I'm like, oh, the problem is solved. And I was wrong. And no, so like, this is the stuff that keeps us up at night. I'm so glad Sally said something because I read it incorrectly, but I don't know if that was a crazy interpretation, but you know.
All right, well, thank you. Any other questions on any of the charters? How many were there total?
Yeah. On this code, there are 10, and in June, we'll have 4 that'll come again in the first. So they'll have been 14, hopefully, when we're all done.
So if they're comfortable voting on the 9, we'll bring screening back, correct?
In June, yeah, we can bring
right.
Screening. Yeah.
So we can do it
that. So we'll just vote. So how? The proposal is, if everyone is ready. Oh, okay. Sorry, I don't know why I'm missing hands. Oh, yeah. Now I see Diane. Yeah.
Just one thing, is that anywhere else in any of the charters? Because now, like, I can go back and read, but if we clarify it here, I don't remember seeing it somewhere else. I think it's typically the number of bar members in good standing, but just for consistency, if someone is, you know, knows that off the top of their head.
I don't believe there is another one.
I don't remember seeing it, but.
I'm scrolling through them now.
Okay. I am.
While
too.
They're flipping through, just to make sure that we're consistent, assuming that that quick review that Bob and Itam are doing shows that there is no similar language in any of the other 9 charters that we discussed today, would the board be comfortable voting on the 9, not the screening committee? We'll take that back, we'll revise it, we'll re-present that in June. So we'll vote on 9 today, and then we'll vote on the screening committee and the other 4 in June.
Okay.
I'm hearing no, that the language that you pointed, that Sally pointed out, does not exist in any of the other charters that we presented for today's meeting. So given that, I'm hearing a lot of nods with the procedure that I suggested, that Bob suggested. Do I hear a motion to approve the 9 charters that were presented today with the exclusion of the 10th charter, the screening charter?
So moved.
I have a motion and a second. All in favor, please signify by saying aye or raising your hand.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, please say nay. All right, the ayes have it and the motion has passed. So thank you very much, everyone. And thank you so much to Adam and also to Monica and to the many other members of the committees who reviewed these charters to get us to voting today. So thank you, everyone. And we will come back with the screening committee charter and the other 4 and present those in June. And now, we are to our budget committee report. So Charles, you have the floor.
Thank you, Ellen. So as you all know, last meeting we presented the FY24 budget, and today we want to get your approval regarding that budget. So before you, the budget committee recommendation for the FY24 budget, this budget maintains the same high level of services that we are used to. It executes projects in support of the strategic plan. The members and staff share the inflation impact. We talked about the inflation numbers, while controlling the overall increase to the license fee rate. And this also increases staff salaries to maximize retention by prioritizing existing employees. So the budget reflects a budget deficit of $534,511. This includes a license fee rate increase of $7 to $331 for active members, which is a 2.2% increase, a $4 increase to $206 for inactive members. That's a 2% increase. And the FY24 budget reflects a budgeted deficit in the license fee funded activities of $877,667 and a budgeted surplus in the non-license fee funded activities of $343,157. Are there any questions about, we've discussed this. You know the process we've gone through from February to now, January to now, really. And we ask that you approve the FY24 budget recommendation.
Thank you, Charles. Are there any questions for Charles? All right. Do I have a motion that the board approve the proposed budget as presented?
So moved.
Is there a second? I have a motion and a second. All in favor, please signify by saying aye or raising your hand. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, please say nay. All right, the ayes have it and the budget is passed. Congratulations. Many, many thanks to Charles, the rest of the committee, Mar, the rest of the staff. I mean, where's Mar? This process actually starts much farther back than January. That's kind of when the board first hears about it, but the staff starts on it in October, I think, if not before. So lots of work goes into this, as it should. I mean, this is important. We are the steward of significant funds that we hold and we spend on behalf of our bar and legal community. So thank you very much to everyone who took part in putting this budget together.